All right, we're dealing with Exodus 16 to 18, actually 15 to 18, because we didn't get through with 15 last time, only introduced it. So we're going to pick up at chapter 15 here in just a moment and work our way through the 18th chapter. We are finishing this first major section of the Exodus, and then next time we'll start into 19, which is the section on the law. That doesn't mean there's not any law prior to 19 or there's not anything concerning the Exodus after that, but that's how Baxter outlines it, and I like what he's done with that. And so we finish that history on that outline, the history section, and the law then starts again at chapter 19. So we're going to shift gears next time. So let's review our chapters here. We have 12 or 14 rather to cover, 15 to cover actually. Chapter 1. Suffering in Egypt, yes, the children of Israel suffer in Egypt. Chapter 2, a leader is born. What's his name? Moses. Moses, birth in his early life. Chapter 3, yeah, the call of Moses in order to deliver the people of God. Then what did Moses do? Chapter 4, made excuses, and he made a trip to Egypt. Chapter 5 was the first time he made a request to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's response was increased suffering. Chapter 6, God gave something to, yeah, to assurance to Moses and to Israel. Chapter 7, all right, here's where we start the plague. We have Aaron's rod budded, and then we have the first plague, which helps us to understand or remember what chapter 8 is about. If that's the first plague, chapter 8 is second, third, and fourth, then guess what the next chapter starts with? The fifth. Yeah, fifth and the sixth and the seventh, and then chapter 10, the eighth and the ninth. Then chapter 11 was what? The announcement of the 10th plague. That 10th plague doesn't take place, but we have the announcement of that. Chapter 12 deals with, or you need to remember this chapter, Passover, yeah, and the 10th plague. And so we'll come time and again to the 12th chapter. When we get further in the Old Testament, we'll say something about the Passover, and we'll go back to chapter 12, at least in reference if we don't turn over there. Chapter 13. Yeah. All right, we have the firstborn being sanctified in the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. Then chapter 14, the last chapter we covered, crossing of the sea. So that's the actual Exodus for which the book is named. They are leaving, exiting the land of Egypt. Then chapter 15 we didn't cover, but what does it deal with? All right, Song of Deliverance. We have a song of Moses and the song of Miriam. Who's Miriam? His sister. All right. All right, here's chapter 15. Let's get that because we do have some ground to cover. Let's cover chapter 15. Several things here we want to pay attention to. Call this chapter simply a song of deliverance. They have been delivered, chapter 14, that is the Exodus, the coming through the Red Sea, and we have a song of deliverance. This reminds us of the book of Revelation, chapter 15. You might make a connection with Revelation 15 and 3. We read there about the song of Moses and alluding to this concept here in this chapter. I think I'm right in saying this, that this is the first worship singing that's mentioned in the history of Israel. I don't mean by that that they'd never sung before. Maybe they did. Maybe they sang while they were in Egypt. Maybe they sang before they went into Egypt. I don't know. I don't remember a mentioning of that. To my knowledge, this is the first. And if you've got one, you say, well, that, no, you missed it over here in Genesis, whatever. Okay, I was wrong. But I think I'm right on that. This is the first mentioning of worship singing in Israel, for what that may be worth. That may get you winning a Bible trivia game, maybe, but I don't know what. But this is important if this is the first time we're seeing that. We're going to see the first reference to observing the Sabbath also here in our book tonight. So we're seeing some first. All right, let's talk about this song of Moses. Moses sang a song. And the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord. And here is the division of that, as I have put it. Songs in Hebrew poetry, which we'll get into more when we get to books like Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Those are Hebrew poetry. They don't have the rhythm or rhyme that we have in our Western poetry. But quite often, and we see that here, a statement will be made and then another statement made that says essentially the same thing, and then maybe the same thing is said again and the same thing may be said again. Well, we do that in our singing often as well. But I think there are major points, and here they are. The first one, I think, is the focus on that Egypt is defeated. Egypt was their enemy in the sense that Egypt had held them captive. So we're not going to notice every word, but the Lord is my strength, verse 2. The Lord is a man of war in verse 3. But verse 4 and 5 is the key to that first section, and that is Pharaoh and his chariots and his armies are cast into the sea. The depths have covered them, verse 5, and they sank to the bottom like a stone. I don't know if we want to divide this in four verses. I'm not sure it was in verses as we think of it. But in our thought pattern of songs, the first verse seems to focus on Egypt is defeated. They drowned in the sea. We watched them as the sea closed upon them. That's all I wanted us to see. The second point of the second verse, however you want to view that, is this was by the strength of the Lord. Now that's interesting because this was not by the strength of Moses, not by the strength of Aaron, nor was it by the power of this rod that Moses had, he uses repeatedly, but it's by the strength of the Lord. So let's notice a couple of three key verses here. Verse 6, by your right hand. It's the right hand of God. The right hand is always the strength and power. By his right hand, verse 6, twice, you mentioned your greatness. By the blast, verse 8, of your nostrils. You blew your wind, verse 10. So how did the sea part? It was by the right hand of God. How was it that Egypt was defeated? By the right hand of God. The third section, beginning at verse 11 through verse 13, there's none any greater than God. God is the greatest of all. So who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Fearful in praises. I think fearful is there in the sense not of being afraid of God, but in awe. They're standing in awe of God. It's used in both ways throughout the scriptures. You stretched out your hand. But the point I wanted you to see verse 11. Lost my verse there for a moment. But who is like you among the other gods? There's not another God like you. The Egyptians' gods could not compare. Then interesting that 14 to 19 focuses in this last verse, if you want to call it that, has to do with other nations. Take heed to that. That there are other nations that pay attention to that. Let me give you some evidence of that. That Jethro is over in the land of, who's Jethro, by the way? Moses' father-in-law. He is over in the land of Midian. That's a little ways away from Egypt, from the Red Sea where it parted. But chapter 18, verse 1 indicates he had heard about that. He knew about this great deliverance out of Egypt. Word had got to him. So the nations are going to take heed. So notice he mentions the people will hear and be afraid. Well, this message is going to go forth into Canaan. So we're going to have Palestina, we have Edom, we have Moab, we have Canaan. They're going to melt. And now at 16 through verse 18, I've written a marginal note. I see that section is telling us God is working his plan and his purpose out. Call it providence, call it whatever you wish. God's working his plan out. And so this was part of God working his plan. You say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, with his great arm that God's still on his throne. But look at verse 17. You will bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance in a place, O Lord, of which you have made for your own dwelling, the sanctuary of the Lord, which your hand has established. In other words, you took your people out of Egypt and you're going to put them where you want them to accomplish what you want them to accomplish. I'm paraphrasing. Does that make sense? So this was not just a thing where the timing happened to be just right where the wind was blowing and they got across, but God was working out his plan and his purpose. Make sense? So what a song we have, song of deliverance. Egypt is defeated, this is by God, none is greater than God, and our great and mighty God. Now that's interesting to me that Israel is singing along with him about how great their God is, and it's no time till they are complaining about God not taking care of them. Now, they didn't say God didn't take care of them. They said Moses wasn't doing his job. But God said, no, you're talking about me is what you're talking about. All right. Now then, verse 19, the horses of the Egyptians drowned as the sea came back. All right, let's move to the song of Miriam. Miriam is his sister. She's a prophetess. And she took the timbrel in her hand and all the women and they who went out after her and they danced. I don't take that, that's a there's nothing in the context would indicate that's a sensual dance. But it's more of a dance of celebration. When we think of dance, particularly as we preach against dancing, we think of a sensual bodily contact. But all of us probably have an excitement over something. If you are a sports fan, you've probably stood on the sidelines or jumped up and cheered and jumped up and down, and you're dancing around. Well, I don't do that in many sports activities. Maybe the horse show, but not for baseball or basketball. But you do get excited. And you're dancing. There is this celebration. It's a celebratory kind of dance is what I take it to be. There are two points to be made in her song, and then I want us to move to the bitter waters. One is that the victory came by the Lord. Same thing Moses had said. Sing to the Lord, for he triumphed graciously. Not we, but he triumphed graciously, gloriously. And then the second point was the defeat of Egypt. The horse and the rider are thrown into the sea. So she made the same points that Moses did, but she's celebrating with her dancing. All right, now let's move on and talk about the bitter waters. I know I'm hurrying a little bit in chapter 15, but we're a little behind because this was last week's material. Let's talk about the bitter waters. That Moses and Israel, he brought them from the Red Sea. Let's get a map here, and then we'll come back to our outline. Last time we talked about, if you can follow my little dot here, they came out and this is the traditional route. It's thought that they crossed the Red Sea here. Others think they crossed the Red Sea here, and this is over here is the Mount Sinai, etc. I think I'm more leaning in this direction. But anyway, be that as it may, they come out into the wilderness and they make their way, and we're about to get them down here to Marah. That's where this event takes place. Make sense? If that's not where it is, then we've got to place Marah over here somewhere, and some have made attempts to do that. But this is thought to be where Marah is here in this wilderness as they come out of the sea. So right there in the middle of that circle is where Marah is. All right, let's get what goes on here. What happens when they get to Marah? They come through the wilderness of Shur, and they come to this place called Marah. And they couldn't find water they could drink. There was water, but it was bitter water. So therefore the name of it was called Marah, which simply means bitter. So that's what that means. All right. So the people murmured and cried out against Moses, and what shall we drink? So notice at verse 25, you might get ready to make a marginal note because this is going to be something applicable all the way through next trimester as we end even into the next one as we get through Deuteronomy, particularly in Numbers, this is going to be true. Let's see what we can find at verse 25. The Lord showed him a tree and cast it, told him to cast it on the water and made the water sweet. And then he made a statute and ordinance for them, and there he tested them. Here's the thing I just learned from that. We're going to see this all through Numbers. Problems in the wilderness were a test. I don't know that that means that God had made that water bitter. Maybe he did. But since the water was bitter, he lets them get there and see they can't drink of it. And they ought to be able to figure out if God could part that sea, he can provide water for us even though water is bitter. But they can't figure that out. So God allows them to have problems in order to test them. They're going to have more problems, and that's going to be a test. And he's going to allow them to have more problems, and it's going to be a test. Does that make sense? So make a marginal note there. We'll come back to that at different times, that God allowed that to test them. So, again, notice the miracle that has been performed. This ought to be confirming their faith in God. You take this branch or this part of a tree, cast it into the water that's bitter, There's no evidence that that's going to suddenly make it better, but it is symbolic of the healing of the water, so it's a miracle, obviously. And that ought to make them think, you know what, God's taking care of us. Doesn't work. Let's talk about verse 26, that if he reminded them, if you diligently heed my voice and do what's right and give ear to my commandments, then God will put none of these diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians. So what's he talking about? I'm not sure. It may be that it refers to some, or at least one of the plagues, like the boils. Some argue that. And perhaps Deuteronomy 28, 27 may give some credence to that concept. Is that 100%? Am I 100% with that one? No. But that's a possibility. Some think that it refers to these diseases that are brought upon the Egyptians, that it must be referring to the plagues. Well, all the plagues weren't diseases. Darkness wasn't a disease, but the boils was a disease. So some think that it refers to the boils, that if you follow me and you listen to me, I'm not going to let this happen to you. None of these diseases that are brought upon the Egyptians. Some think that maybe it's just generally diseases that and sickness that the Egyptians had experienced. And it must be interpreted in light of the bitter water seemed to, as I believe as Callan Daitlich had argued this, I'm not sure, that the bitter water seemed to threaten their health, maybe even threaten death upon them. And they're thinking, we're going to drink this and we're going to die. No, wait a minute, you listen to me and you obey my voice, none of the diseases of the threat is going to happen to you if you'll listen to me. So what exactly was it the boils? Well, probably included that. Did it include other diseases? Probably. I don't know how to be more specific. Does that make sense? All right. Then where did they go? Verse 27. All right, Elam, which is... Here is Marah. If I can get my... That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to go right here. There we go. It's just right down from that, right here, where my little mark is there. So that's where they are, is they are at Elam. So that ends chapter 16. And what did they find when they got to Elam? All right. Yeah, they found some springs and they found water there. All right, let's go to chapter 16 now. Manna from heaven. This gets interesting now. That they journeyed from Elam, the text says, in verses 1 to 3. And where do they go now? From Elam, they came to the wilderness of Sin. Here we are, this wilderness of Sin. I mean, right here in that circle between Elam and Sinai. Sinai down at the bottom of the peninsula there. All right, what happens in verses 1 to 3? When they got there, all right, you might underline verse 2, they murmured against Moses. Let's flag some parallel verses to that, if you're so disposed to do that. 14 and 11. Why are we flagging these verses in the margin of our text? To remind us, this was not a one-time incident. They have already done this, 14:11. That's Exodus 14:11. They're doing it here at 16 and 2, and then also flag 17 and 3, chapter 17, verse 3. So they murmur against Moses. They murmur against Moses. They murmur against Moses. And guess what? They murmur against Moses again and again. This is not over. And so they complained that we had plenty to eat there in the in Egypt. And you brought us out here to kill us. They've forgotten what God's done for them, apparently. All right. Now let's go back to our outline. So the people murmured for food. And again, that's serving as a test. Do they turn to God and say, God, provide, would you please provide food? Because we know you have power. We saw you turn water, bitter water to sweet. We saw the waters part, et cetera, et cetera. No. They murmur against Moses. Now, 4 to 8, what does God do? All right. Yes, God points out to them, and he doesn't do this till we get to verse 7, but he points out to them, you're not complaining against Moses, you're complaining against me. So let's notice verse 4. God said, I will rain bread from heaven. I'm going to provide for them. I'm going to paraphrase verse 4. I'm going to give them plenty, and they'll gather their quota that I may test them. Here's another test. I'm going to see if these people will be obedient, see if they'll ever learn their lesson. I'm going to test them whether they will walk in my law or not. And so on the sixth day they can prepare, and we'll get to that in a moment. Now verse 6, at the evening you shall know the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you'll see the glory of the Lord. Well, if we had never read this story and we didn't go any further, how in the morning are you going to see and conclude the Lord brought us out of the land of Egypt and see the glory of the Lord? Well, it's in the morning. They're getting their quail. In the evening, they're getting their manna. And when they see that, they ought to conclude from that, since God rains down food upon them, it's the Lord that brought us out of Egypt. So here's what I'm learning from that. Even though they knew and saying in chapter 15, the Lord brought us out of Egypt by the power of the Lord, do you think they mentally got it fixed in their minds that was by the power of God? I don't think so. You say, why do you not think so? Because I think God's telling us they ain't got it yet. Does that make sense? They ain't got it. All right. Let's look at verse 7. Moses said, but what are we that you murmur against us? Verse 8, Moses said, what are we? What's Moses saying? Absolutely. Something we hadn't talked about in the last chapter or two that maybe they've forgotten about, there is something leading them. Not just, I mean, God's doing it, but God's leading them by cloud and by pillar of fire. And Moses, I think, is reminding them, I'm not the one leading you. I didn't lead you out in the wilderness. God led you in the wilderness. God led you through the sea. God parted the sea. God did all of that. Who am I? I'm just the leader that God has appointed. And notice at the end of verse 8, your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord. So every time they cry out against Moses, those passages we flag, 17:3, 14:11, and 16:2, all of those are murmuring against God. So let's get 9 to 21 now. God sent them quail, and God sent them manna. So, beginning at verse 10, Moses and Aaron spoke to the children of Israel and said, you'll see the glory of the Lord appear in a cloud, and I've heard your murmurings, verse 12, and at twilight you shall eat meat in the morning and be filled with bread. And then notice at the end of verse 12, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. Do they not have that in their mind yet? I think the answer is no. I think God is saying, this gives you evidence. If I'm raining this down, this gives you evidence, then you shall know that I'm the Lord. All right, so what happens at verse 14? You're going to see a layer of dew, and there'll be this small substance as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? If you're reading from the New King James, English Standard, New American Standard, etc., your translation will say, what is it? If you're reading from the King James, good translation, it doesn't say, what is it? It says, manna. The word manna means, what is it? That's why they called it manna. They see this fine food on the ground. By fine, I mean it's very small, and it's fine as frost. Let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 31. The name of it was manna. Your footnote will say, what or what is it? You would too if you went out in the morning, and the whole ground, every far as you can see, there's little bits of food like fine as frost, and it was like coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers with honey. There's your description. You would probably say, what is it? That's why they called it that. Now, let's talk about that just for a moment. That's coriander seeds. It looks a little large for the description here. I ask artificial intelligence to draw me a picture based on the description you can read in Exodus 16:31 and additional information you can find in the book of Exodus. Is that what it looked like? I don't know. But that did better than I could draw. Something that was small, something circular, like coriander seed. Well, okay, I got it. Looked like frost on the ground. What did it look like? The answer is we don't really know. But maybe that gives us a general idea. All right. Now, what are, let's go a little bit further. Look at verse 16 now. How much could they take? All right. Basically a day's supply. You'll take one omer. So if you don't have marginal notes that explain that to you, get ready to make one. An omer is 4.2 pints. Between 2 and 3 liters, between 1.5 to 2 quarts. But 4.2 pints, according to Manna Software. All right. So that's basically a day's supply. Could they take more than that? No, they were not to take more than that. Not on the weekdays. They could on the 6th day, and we'll get to that in a moment. And what would happen if they're not to leave anything over? That is, don't get some that you're going to put up for the next day, because if you save some for the next day, what happens? It'll be covered in worms and stink. And so they gathered every morning, and according to what the man's need. All right. Now let's start at verse 22 through verse 36. So God sends the quail, God sends the manna. You'd think that's enough. They parted the sea, they made the bitter water sweet, God's feeding them with manna, they've got it now. Let's see what the regulations are. Verses 22 to 31, what goes on? They were not to gather on the Sabbath day. We'll come back to the Sabbath. Let's just leave that for a moment. They're not to gather on the Sabbath day, but on the 6th day, gather twice as much. And in that case, what's left in the morning doesn't stink, nor do the worms get it. That's interesting. But if they did it on another day, is that not some symbol that God was controlling this? So on Tuesday, they get some extra and say, I'm going to slip this back, and they go in there and it stinks. But on Saturday, they get it and put some extra back for Sunday, and it's okay. I had to tell them something. But anyway, look at verse 28. And Moses said, the Lord said to Moses, rather, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments? Well, that's based on verse 27. What were the people doing? They're trying to go out on the Sabbath and gather some when they weren't supposed to. And so they're not listening. God had already said, remember, none of the diseases are going to come upon you if you listen to me. They're not listening. All right, let's pause for a moment and make a couple of points about the Sabbath. For what it's worth to you, verse 26, the 7th day is the Sabbath. And you say, well, I know that. No, everybody don't know that. You hear people talk about their Sunday being the Christian Sabbath. And this is the Christian Sabbath. Well, on Sunday, that's our Christian Sabbath. Sunday's the 1st day of the week. The Sabbath is the 7th day of the week, all through the scriptures, Matthew 28, verse 1, etc. That's a good place to make that point. Let's go back to verse 23. Tomorrow is the Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath. This is the beginning that, as far as we know of the Sabbath observance. Now, in creation, God had made the 7th day a special day because it was the day he rested. And we're going to see later in the law, we hadn't got there yet. And Exodus, we're going to, a little later in Exodus, we're going to see that they were to keep the Sabbath because God rested on the 7th day. So it's tied back to creation. But here's the point. There is no indication that they had been keeping the Sabbath during their stay in Egypt. If they were, we have no record of that. There's nothing in the text that tells us that. So we have the beginning of singing. We have the beginning of the Sabbath observance as far as the record shows. You say, well, I think they did in Egypt. Have at it. I just don't think you have any evidence of that. Does that make sense to you? So that's an interesting little tidbit that we see there. Now, at verse 31, again, is your description of that manna that we've already talked about. Now, let's get 32 to 36 to finish the chapter. What's going on here? This finishes... Take an omer, that's a day's allowance. You take that and you put it up, and it's not going to rot. It's not going to stink. It's not, the worm's not going to get it. And that's to be, what's going to be done with that eventually? We don't know that yet, but let's fast forward through our book, and what's going to be done with that? Say again? It's going in the Ark of the Covenant, yes. But we don't know that just yet. We'll get that a little bit later. All right, any questions or comments on chapter 16, manna from heaven? God's taking care of his people. Do you begin to understand a little more of Acts 7, passages like that talk about the rebellion and the stubbornness of the children of Israel that we hadn't even got into the wilderness wanderings yet? We ain't even got there yet. And we're seeing stubbornness and stubbornness and stubbornness. Questions, comments? Let's go to 17. Two things happen here. We have water from the rock and the war with the Amalekites. And then we're going to try to get through 18 if we can. So chapter 17, short chapter. And verse 17 said, and all the children of Israel... all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin. All right. Here's where we are. We're down here in the wilderness of Sin. They have left Elam, so they're somewhere down in here between Elam and Sinai, and they're making their way towards Sinai. We'll be at Sinai, chapter 19. So this is where we are in our journey. Now, if you're reading from the English Standard, New American Standard, it'll say they moved by stages. And that's interesting. They move by stages, which probably just simply means, and I think there's probably a textual, I'm not sure. I meant to go back and check, but I think there's a textual variation. Some maybe is the reason why they went by stages in one translation and another one doesn't mention that. Holman's Christian translates that they move from one place to another place. That's the idea of stages. I don't think it meant that some of these people moved and then some of these people moved and then some of these people moved. But they may have done that because of the large crowd, but they moved from one place to another as they're making their way towards Sinai. Not a big deal. Verse 1 said, where did they come? They went to the next place. They camped at Rephidim. All right, here's Rephidim right here in the middle of the circle. Right here, just before Sinai. So we've taken them from up here through Mara to Elam to Rephidim, is where we are now. Now, before we forget it, let's flag verse 3. If you're making marginal notes, flag 16 and 13 and 14 and verse 11. I said 16 and 2, I'm sorry. I don't know why I put 13. 16 and 2 and 14 and verse 11. Here they're murmuring against Moses again. What's the complaint this time? We don't have any water. And notice the charge, verse 3. You brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and livestock. So Moses cried out to the Lord and said, they are almost ready to stone me. What does God do? Tells him to take your rod, the same rod that he had used to separate the waters. He uses it here to go strike the rock and water comes forth. Now that's absolutely amazing. Quails come down from heaven, manna comes down from heaven, but he strikes a rock and water comes forth. That's not the last time water's going to come forth. Numbers 20, we're going to see it again. But God didn't tell him to strike it, and he did. Remember that occasion? All right. But not that's later on. We get to that next trimester. So they call the name of the place Massah or Meribah, and we'll read often about the waters of Meribah throughout the scriptures. So it's called Massah because they tempted the Lord, and called Meribah because it was a place of contention. There was a contention, and they tempted the Lord and asking, is the Lord not among us? So we'll read about that often, and we'll flag Exodus 17 as the place where that took place. Waters of Meribah, we'll talk about frequently. Talk about the war of the Amalekites. Who were the Amalekites? They were descendants from Esau, and where were they located? Well, they were a nomadic tribe in Sinai, and perhaps scattered in other places as well, but there was a group of them apparently in the lower part of the Sinai Peninsula in this region, and they come along and they attack the children of Israel. Now, notice that when they attack them, well, let me give you this first before we get there. Deuteronomy 25, you might flag or put Deuteronomy 25 in the margin of your text. In verses 17 to 19, in interest of time, I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to tell you what it says, and you can flag it. But they attacked the rear of the children of Israel when they were worn out and they were weak. I'm paraphrasing. So as they're making their travels and their journey, and as they are weak and they're worn out, they attack the rear. Well, that's not where the strength of the people is. It's in the front, where their fighting men would be. So it was an unjustified attack. And so, as some commentators pointed out, the defeat of the Amalekites and the killing of the Amalekites was well justified. That this is God punishing them for the unjust attack on his people. Now, let's get a couple of things in that, and then we're going to go to chapter 18 as time permits. So Moses, God tells Moses he's going to fight the Amalekites. So what does God tell him to do? I want you to do this, and I want you to appoint somebody else. What's he do? Is a man going to be basically, he's not called this in the text, but you appoint one man to be the general to lead the army. And that man's name is Joshua. Send him out as the leader. You and Aaron and Hur, we know little about Hur. He's a helper of Moses, and that's about what we know. An assistant of Moses. Those three, God must have known what was going to happen. You go up on the mountain, and what's now he's going to do with this rod? You hold it up, and when you hold it up, Israel is victorious. Moses lets it down. What happens? They start losing. So the battle goes on for a good while, and Moses' arm gets tired. And so what does he put under his arm? Supports it with a rock, doesn't he? He's still tired. Why do we need Aaron and Hur? They support his arm and hold it up. They lift up his hands. I think maybe that's the idea where we get the concept lifting up hands. Well, part of that may be lifting up hands in prayer, but lifting up our hands. When you're doing what's right, if I encourage you, I'm lifting up your hands. I'm like Aaron and Hur standing there. I'll help you keep that hand up so we can be victorious. Let's fight together. They did a very important job of holding his hand up, and they were victorious. Now, for what it's worth, let's make a note about 1 Samuel 15. Verse 14, God had said, I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Now, if we don't know our history, we'd think, okay, it's about to happen. But then God said, there's going to be war from generation to generation. Whoa, wait a minute. I thought you're going to wipe them out, and then you say you're going to keep fighting. That promise was not fulfilled until after 1 Samuel 15. God often makes promises that are fulfilled generations in advance. And just because it's not immediately fulfilled doesn't mean God didn't promise it and it won't be fulfilled. Did God finally do what he said? Yeah. But he didn't do it in Moses' day, nor in Joshua's day. So I know from 1 Samuel 15, the battle's still going on. It was after that, before that was fulfilled. Make sense? I learned a very powerful lesson. All right, now we've got about 4 minutes to go, so let's see if we can get through 18 now. This is fairly familiar territory. There's a man named Jethro. Who is Jethro? We've seen him before. Moses' father-in-law. Verse 1 said, and I'm paraphrasing, he heard about what happened in the deliverance from Egypt. And so that's testimony that God was right, that our Moses was right in his song, the nations are going to hear. Even his father-in-law heard over there in Midian. He's a priest, the text tells us. And he comes back, he comes and meets Moses there in the Sinai Peninsula and brings Zipporah, his wife, back. Remember, she had gone Exodus 4. You hadn't seen her since Exodus 4. Gershom, his son, is mentioned in Exodus 2 and 22, but Eliezer has not been mentioned before. He's been referred to, but this is our first time to see his name. It's another first for us. First time his name is mentioned. And they basically get together and they want to know how each other's doing and et cetera. So the meeting goes well, very well received. And Jethro praises the God of heaven. Now I'm interested in verses 12 through verse 13, actually through verse 27. Jethro observes something. What does he observe? A problem. Yeah, and remember, there were 600,000 fighting men came out, and we've given estimates from 1.2 to 2 million people. But let's just take a low estimate of 2 million people. Can you imagine being the sole judge of all the problems that arises with a million people? Let's cut that in half, make it 500,000. Would you want to be the sole judge? Can you imagine how many cases are coming to you that to be settled and some problems and some issues? And so Jethro said, you're going to wear yourself out. So what does he suggest? Yeah, he said, this is not good. What you need is, you need some help. You need to, beginning at verse 17 through 23, my advice to you is you need to select some able men. So notice the qualification. Able men, number one, who fear God. Men of truth, number three, and they hate covetousness. Quite a list of qualities, isn't it? You appoint these men, reminds me of Acts 6, doesn't it you? And you appoint them over thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens, and let them judge the people, and let them bring the weightier matters to you. And so the more difficult things that can't be figured out, let them bring it to you. And so Moses, verses 24 to 27, follows his advice and did exactly all that he had said, verse 24. Now you might make a marginal note just here that'll be helpful perhaps. Deuteronomy 1, 9 through 18 is where these judges were appointed. So they're not appointed just yet. He did that, and so maybe I need to rephrase that. Verse 24 seems to indicate that he did. The details of that, Deuteronomy 1, okay? So I'm not saying they weren't appointed. I didn't mean to leave that impression. The details are not given just yet. We'll get to that in Deuteronomy. So we're a few weeks off, months off before we get to that. We get to that in January in our studies. Questions or comments on that? I learned a very practical thing right here, and then we're going to stop. From Deuteronomy 18, we dealt with this in our leadership class, that delegation is important. Those who are in leadership position need to learn to delegate. Could you see to this? Could you see to that? And can you do this? Because leaders cannot do everything by themselves, nor should they try. And Jethro had some pretty good advice for that. Any other questions or comments? We'll stop there.